My anger wasn't arbitrary. It was incredibly specific. My anger was repeating, "Glennon, for you, familial intimacy with Craig is safe. Physical and emotional intimacy are not." I knew this. My body knew this. And I had been ignoring what I knew. That is why I was so angry. I was angry at myself. Craig was the one who had strayed, yes, but I was the one who decided, day after day, to stay married, vulnerable, and angry. I was ignoring what I knew, and I was punishing him for forcing me to know it. There was nothing he could do to change what I knew. Maybe the question was no longer, how could he have done this to me? But how can I keep doing this to myself? Maybe instead of forever repeating, how could he have abandoned me? I needed to ask, why do I keep abandoning myself? Eventually, I decided to stop abandoning myself, which meant honoring my anger. I didn't need to prove to anyone else whether leaving was right or wrong. I didn't need to justify my anger anymore. What I needed to do was forgive the father of my children. I was able to do that as soon as I divorced him. After the divorce mediation, Craig and I stood side by side in an elevator, watching the floor numbers light up one at a time while we descended. I looked over at Craig, and for the first time in years, I felt true empathy, tenderness, and warmth toward him. Once again, I could see him as a good man with whom I'd like to be friends. I felt real forgiveness. That was because for the first time in years, I felt safe. I'd restored my own boundaries. I'd begun to trust myself because I'd become a woman who refuses to abandon herself to keep false peace. I have friends who did find safety and lasting forgiveness inside their marriages after infidelity. What comes after betrayal cannot be striving, contorting, or suffering to honor an arbitrary idea of right or wrong. What comes next must be an honoring of self. We must disregard the should out there and face what is real in here. If constant anger is what is real in here, we must address it both for ourselves and for the other. Because it is not kind to keep those we can't forgive close to us and punish them forever. If we cannot forgive and move on, perhaps we need to move on first, and forgiveness will follow. Forgiveness does not mean access. We can give the other person the gift of forgiveness and ourselves the gift of safety and freedom at the very same time. When both people become unafraid and unpunished, that is a good goodbye. Relief from anger is not something that is bestowed upon us. It often must be forged by us. Anger delivers important information about where one of our boundaries has been crossed. When we answer the door and accept that delivery, we begin to know ourselves better. When we restore the boundary that was violated, we honor ourselves. When we know ourselves and honor ourselves, we live with integrity, peace, and power, understanding that we are the kind of woman who will be wise and brave enough to care for herself. Good stuff. And there's more. Even better stuff comes when we go deeper. When we say, okay, I understand that this is my boundary, but what is a boundary anyway? A boundary is the edge of one of our root beliefs about ourselves and the world. We are like computers, and our beliefs are the software with which we're programmed. Often our beliefs are programmed into us without our knowledge by our culture, community, religion, and family. Even though we don't choose those subconscious programs, they run our lives. They control our decisions, perspectives, feelings, and interactions, so they determine our destiny. What we believe, we become. There is nothing more important than unearthing what we really believe to be true about ourselves and our world, and nothing unearths what we really believe faster than examining what pisses us off. My anger at my ex-husband was a relentless doorbell trying to alert me that a major boundary of mine had been crossed. My boundary was the edge of this root belief of mine. The most important values in a marriage are honesty, loyalty, and faithfulness, and when those are gone, I am no longer safe. That belief of mine was neither right nor wrong. Beliefs have nothing to do with objective universal morality and everything to do with each person's specific personal one. In this case, I decided to accept and keep this root belief about marriage and loyalty because it served me, made me feel safe, and felt true to me. I accepted that delivery and brought it right into my second marriage. But sometimes, my anger delivers to my door a root belief that I don't want to keep. Abby works hard and rests hard. Often in the middle of a weekday, she will lie down on our couch and watch zombie shows. When she does this, I get clenched and tight. I get agitated, then angry, because she is relaxing at me. I start tidying loudly and aggressively in the couch's vicinity. She hears my violent tidying and asks, "What's wrong?" I say, "Nothing," with a tone that suggests something. This dance plays out again and again, Abby relaxing on the couch and me getting angry about it, and Abby getting angry that I'm getting angry. We talk this out again and again. You have not seen talking until you've seen the incessant talking of two married women who are introspective spiritual seekers and also sober, so they have nothing else to do. We adore each other. We never want to hurt each other. We want to understand each other and ourselves, so we really want to get to the bottom of things. So we talk and we talk, and we always seem to arrive at this conclusion. Abby is a grown woman, and she is the boss of herself. Glennon should stop feeling angry about Abby's decisions. I always agree with this conclusion. My mind does, at least. But how do I get this memo to my body? What do I do with should? Should never helps me because I am dealing with what is. Layering a judgment on top of a feeling doesn't change the feeling. How do I not become angry? How do I not become activated? One day, I walked into our family room and saw Abby jump off the couch and begin straightening pillows, trying to look busy and productive for my sake. I stopped in my tracks and stared at her while a memory from childhood floated into my mind. When I was young, if I was at home relaxing on the couch and I heard my parents' car pull up in the driveway, I'd panic, jump off the couch, and try to look busy before they opened the door. Exactly like I'd just seen Abby do. That's when I stopped looking at Abby and thinking, "What is my anger telling me about her?" and started asking, "What is my anger telling me about me?" My anger was delivering a package with one of my root beliefs in it, a belief that was programmed into me during my childhood. Resting is laziness, and laziness is disrespect. Worthiness and goodness are earned with hustle. When Abby rested right in front of me, outside family-designated and approved resting times, she was challenging that root belief. She was activating it, unearthing it, bringing it into the light where I could see it. But unlike my root belief about honesty and fidelity, I didn't like this one. It didn't feel true to me. Because when I looked at Abby relaxing, my anger was almost a bitter yearning. Must be nice. Must be nice to rest in the middle of the damn day. Must be nice to feel worthy of the space you take up on the earth without hustling to earn it every minute. Must be nice to rest and still feel worthy. I want to be able to rest and still feel worthy too. I didn't want to change Abby. I wanted to change my belief about worthiness. Anger rings our bell and delivers one of our root beliefs. This is good information. But the next part is more than informative, it's transformational. all of the beliefs that anger delivers come with a return label. There is a sticker on the package that says, "Here is one of your root beliefs. Would you like to keep, return, or exchange this one?" I looked hard at the root belief about worthiness that my anger at Abby had delivered to me. I thought, no, I don't want to keep this one. It was inherited by me, not created by me. I have outgrown it. It is no longer my truest, most beautiful belief about worthiness. I know better than this belief. It's harsh and it's hurting me in my marriage. I don't want to pass this one down to my kids. But I don't want to return it either. I want to exchange it for this amended one. Hard work is important. So are play and non-productivity. My worth is tied not to my productivity, but to my existence. I am worthy of rest. Changing my root belief about worthiness has changed my life. I sleep a little bit later. I schedule in time for reading and walks and yoga. And sometimes, on the weekend, I even watch a TV show in the middle of the day. It's heavenly. It's also an ongoing process. Still, when I see Abby relaxing, my knee-jerk reaction is annoyance. But then I check myself. I think, why am I activated here? Oh, yes, that old belief. Oh, wait, never mind, I've exchanged that one. And when Abby asks, what's wrong? I can say, nothing, honey, and mean it, mostly. Anger delivers our boundaries to us. Our boundaries deliver our beliefs to us. Our beliefs determine how we experience the world. So even though it can be scary, we'd be wise to answer the door. Heartbreak. After a decade of listening to women, I'm convinced that our deepest fears are 1, living without ever finding our purpose, 2, dying without ever finding true belonging. Again and again, women ask me, how do I find my purpose? How do I find my people? My best advice? When heartbreak rings, answer the door. This is what it sounds like to refuse to answer the door. I wish I could learn more about that injustice. I wish I could visit that sick friend. I wish I could get involved with that cause. I wish I could read that article. I wish I could show up for that family. But I can't bear to because it'll break my heart. It's like we really believe that our hearts were meant to be kept hidden away, bubble wrapped, and under lockdown, as though the point of life is not to be moved. That's not the point. When we let ourselves be moved, we discover what moves us. Heartbreak is not something to be avoided. It's something to pursue. Heartbreak is one of the greatest clues of our lives. The magic of heartbreak is that each person's doorbell rings in response to something specific. What rings your bell? Is it racial injustice? Bullying? Animal cruelty? Hunger? War? The environment? Kids with cancer? What is it that affects you so deeply that whenever you encounter it, you feel the need to look away? Look there. Where is the pain in the world that you just cannot stand? Stand there. The thing that breaks your heart is the very thing you were born to help heal. Every world changer's work begins with a broken heart. I met a group of women in Iowa who'd each lost a baby to stillbirth or early infant death. They formed a sisterhood, and together, through education and other kinds of support, they've contributed to lowering the stillbirth rate in their state so significantly that doctors are scratching their heads in disbelief and gratitude. My theory? Instead of withdrawing or disconnecting from their suffering, they ran straight toward it. Their shared pain became their bond and their fuel. Now, together, they are saving others from the very heartbreak that brought them together. Heartbreak delivers your purpose. If you are brave enough to accept that delivery and seek out the people doing that particular world-changing work, you find your people. There is no bond like the bond that is forged among people who are united in the same world healing work. Despair says, the heartbreak is too overwhelming. I am too sad and too small, and the world is too big. I cannot do it all, so I will do nothing. Courage says, I will not let the fact that I cannot do everything keep me from doing what I can. We all want purpose and connection. Tell me what breaks your heart, and I'll point you toward both. Grief. 14 years ago, I was sitting in my sister's bedroom in the home she shared with her then husband. Tish, just a few months old, lay in her car seat on the hardwood floor, sucking on her fingers and gurgling. Sister and I were quiet. She and her husband were struggling in their marriage, and it was all quite confusing and difficult. While we sat there, her phone pinged and she looked down at it. Then she dropped the phone and slid from her chair to the floor. I grabbed the phone from the floor and saw that her husband had just emailed that their marriage was over. I looked away from the phone and down at my sister, who appeared lifeless, like whatever had been keeping her alive and afloat had gone, like the leftovers of a deflated balloon. Then she began to wail. I have known my sister since moments after she took her first breath, and I had never heard her make a noise like this. Her wail was animalistic, and it made me feel afraid. I touched her, but there was no response. The three of us were in that room together, but we were not together anymore. The pain had taken my sister to a place all her own. Tish was completely still, her eyes wide and watery, stunned by the volume and intensity of the wailing. I remember wondering how a baby exposed to this much raw pain this early would be formed by it. In the coming year, while the rest of the world carried on, my sister, Tish, and I became a small army trying to push together through the muck of grief. Sometimes I think that first year shaped Tish's depth and tenderness. She still becomes still, wide-eyed and watery in the presence of another person's pain. My sister moved out of the home she had painstakingly created for her future family and into a small guest room in my basement. I wanted to decorate it, to make it nice for her, but she resisted. She did not want to make a home inside my basement, inside her grief. She wanted to make it clear that she was just visiting this place. The only thing she hung on the wall was a small blue cross I gave her with the inscription, "For I know the plans I have for you, plans to give you hope and a future." Every evening she'd come home from work, eat dinner with us, and do her best to smile and play with the kids. Then she'd walk downstairs to her room for the night. One evening I followed her downstairs and stood outside her door. As I prepared to knock, I heard her crying softly. That is when I realized that where she was, I could not go. Grief is a lonely basement guest room. No one, not even your sister, can join you there. So I sat down on the floor with my back against her bedroom door. I used all I had, my body and my presence, to hold vigil, to guard her process, to place myself between her and anything else that might disturb or hurt her. I stayed there for hours. I came back to her door for that nightly vigil for a very long time. A year later, my sister left that room and walked up the stairs and out the front door of our home. Soon after, she left her job as a corporate lawyer and moved to Rwanda to help prosecute child sex offenders and return land stolen from widows. I watched her go with fear and awe. Then I watched her return to marry a man who cherishes her, with whom she'd build her true and beautiful family. Sometimes, in the years that followed, I'd walk downstairs, stare at the door to that basement guest room, and think, it's like that small, dark room was a cocoon. All that time, she was in there, undergoing a complete metamorphosis. Grief is a cocoon from which we emerge new. Last year, Liz's beloved partner became very sick and started dying. I was far away, so each day I would send her messages that said, "I am sitting outside your door." One day, my mom called and asked, "How is Liz?" I thought for a moment about how to answer. I realized I couldn't because she had asked me the wrong question. I said, "Mama, I think the question is not, how is Liz? The question is, who is Liz? Who will she be when she emerges from this grief?" Grief shatters. If you let yourself shatter and then you put yourself back together piece by piece, you wake up one day and realize that you have been completely reassembled. You are whole again and strong, but you are suddenly a new shape, a new size. The change that happens to people who really sit in their pain, whether it's a sliver of envy lasting an hour or a canyon of grief lasting decades, it's revolutionary. When that kind of transformation happens, it becomes impossible to fit into your old conversations or relationships or patterns or thoughts or life anymore. You are like a snake trying to fit back into old dead skin, or a butterfly trying to crawl back into its cocoon. You look around and see everything freshly with the new eyes you have earned for yourself. There is no going back. Perhaps the only thing that makes grief any easier is to surrender completely to it, to resist trying to hold on to a single part of ourselves that existed before the doorbell rang. Sometimes to live again, we have to let ourselves die completely. We have to let ourselves become completely, utterly new. When grief rings, surrender. There is nothing else to do. The delivery is utter transformation. Invaders. When I began recovery, I thought that my problem was that I ate, drank, and drugged too much. I learned that overeating, drinking, and drugging were actually not my problems. They were my ineffective solutions. My actual problems are clinical depression and anxiety. Being both depressed and anxious is a bit like being Eeyore and Tigger at the same time. It's like always living a little too low and a little too high. It's always struggling to be at the level where life happens, which is here and now. Depression and anxiety are not feelings. Feelings return me to myself. Depression and anxiety are body snatchers that suck me out of myself so that I appear to be there, but I'm really gone. Other people can still see me, but no one can feel me anymore, including me. For me, the tragedy of mental illness is not that I'm sad, but that I'm not anything. Mental illness makes me miss my own life. Depression, for me, is a forgetting, an erasing, a slow fade into nothingness. It is like I run out of Glennon, and there is nothing left but panic that I'm gone forever this time. Depression takes all my vibrant colors and bashes them together until I am gray, gray, gray. Eventually, I get too low to operate, but as I begin to fade, I can usually still accomplish small things, do the dishes, take the kids to school, smile when it seems called for. It's just that it's all forced. I am acting instead of responding because I have forgotten the point. Perhaps this is why so many depressed people become artists, to reclaim the power of answering the question, what is the point? We are clawing at the ground with pen and paper while drowning in quicksand. If depression feels like sinking below, anxiety is a shaky hovering above. Right now, as I write this, I am in the middle of an anxious period that has lasted a few weeks. I know I'm floating into anxiety when I find myself obsessing. Obsessing over the next speech, the kids, the house, my marriage, my body, my hair. Anxiety is feeling terrified about my lack of control over anything, and obsessing is my antidote. Writing is clawing the ground when I'm sinking too low, and obsessing is clawing the ground when I'm hovering too high. I thought I'd been hiding my anxiety until my wife touched my arm and said, "I miss you. You've been gone for a while. Of course, we've been by each other's side virtually nonstop. It's just that living with anxiety, living alarmed, makes it impossible to enter the moment, to land inside my body and be there. I cannot be in the moment because I am too afraid of what the next moment will bring. I have to be ready. The other day, a friend was describing getting a cavity filled at the dentist, and she said, "It's not even the pain I hate the most. It's the anticipation of the pain. I'm sweating, panicking, waiting for it to hurt terribly bad. It never does, but it feels like it's always about to." I said, "Yes, that is how I feel all the time." When one lives in a state of constant vigilance, if something actually goes wrong, forget about it. Full panic. 15 to 100 in 2 seconds flat. Kids 2 minutes late, everyone is dead. Sister doesn't text me back within 30 seconds, definitely dead. Dog coughs, almost dead. Abby's plane delayed, yep, all this was too good to be true, life will never let me be happy, all the death. The good news is that I've figured out many ways to outsmart the body snatchers. Proof of my expertise in this area? I am a clinically depressed, inspirational speaker. I am a diagnosed anxious person whose main job is to convince people that everything's okay. Please note that if I can be these things, anyone can be anything. 5 pro tips to those who live too high and too low. Number 1. Take your damn meds. I am on Lexapro, and I believe it to be, along with all the personal growth shit, the reason I don't have to self-medicate with boxes of wine and Oreos anymore. My favorite song goes like this. Jesus loves me, this I know, for he gave me Lexapro. Once, while playing a family game, Chase read this question to my then husband. If you were going to be stranded on an island, who is the one person you'd bring with you? Craig said, your mom. Chase said, okay, what is the one item you would bring? Craig said, your mom's meds. I do not believe that when we die, one of us will be presented with the She Who Suffered Most trophy. If this trophy does exist, I don't want it. If there are people in your life, parents, siblings, friends, writers, spiritual gurus who judge you for taking prescribed medicine, please ask to see their medical license. If they can show it to you and they happen to be your doctor, consider listening. If not, tell them sweetly to fuck all the way off. They are two-legged people who are calling prosthetics a crutch. They cannot go with you into the dark. Go about your business, which is to suffer less, so you can live more. Number 2, keep taking your damn meds. After you take your meds for a while, you will likely begin to feel better. You will wake up one morning, look at your pills, and think, what was I thinking? I am a perfectly normal human after all. I don't need those things anymore. Going off meds because you feel better is like standing in a torrential rainstorm holding a trusty umbrella that is keeping you toasty and dry, and thinking, wow, I am so dry. It's probably time to get rid of this silly umbrella. Stay dry and alive. Number 3. This is what happens to us. We are in our homes and we start sinking down, 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 or floating up, up, and away. We are fading and freaking out. We are in the bad part. So we make an appointment with our doctor for help. Our appointment is in a few days. We wait. We start to feel a little bit better day by day. The morning of our appointment, as we shower and get into the car, we can't even remember who we were or what we felt like 3 days ago. So we look at the doctor and think, my down self is impossible to explain. I barely remember her. Was that even real? We end up saying something like, I don't know. I get sad. I guess everyone does. I'm fine now, I guess. Then we leave without help. A few days later, we are in our homes, and we start sinking and floating again, and so forth. When you start sinking into the gray, get out your phone or a notebook and write a few notes from your down self to your up self. Write about how you feel right now. This does not need to be a novel, just a note. Here is one of my notes from my down self. It's all gray. I can't feel. I am all alone. No one knows me. I'm too tired to write anymore. Put your note away in a safe place and then call for that appointment. When you go to your appointment, bring your note from your down self. When you sit down with the doctor, you don't need to remember or translate. You just need to say, "Hello, this is me, all showered up and fine looking. I don't need help for this up version of me. I need help for this version of me." Take out your note and hand it over. This is how you take care of your down self. This is one way to become her friend and advocate. When you've been returned to yourself, write yourself another note. Months ago, I threw away my umbrella because I was dry. 2 weeks later, I'd just finished snapping at the kids for the millionth time, and my people were looking at me sideways with scared eyes. I was going through the motions, making lunches, writing words. I just couldn't remember the point of these motions anymore. I realized I was gone again, but I also felt confused. Maybe this is just who I am, actually. I can't remember. So I went to my jewelry box and pulled out the note my up self had written to me. G, you love your life, mostly. The smell of Tisha's hair makes you melt. Sunsets blow your mind every time. You laugh 20 times a day. You see more magic than the average bear. You feel loved. You are loved. You have a beautiful life that you have fought hard for. G. I called my doctor, got back on my meds, and returned myself to me. Take good care of all of yourselves. Fight like hell to keep yourself, and when you lose her, do whatever it takes to return to her. Number 4, know your buttons. My commitment to sobriety is about staying with myself. I don't want to abandon myself ever again, not for long at least. Remember those Staples commercials from a few years ago? A group of people in an office would get stressed out about something and a red easy button would appear out of nowhere. Someone would press that button and the whole office would be transported out of their stress and into a pain-free place. Easy buttons are the things that appear in front of us that we want to reach for because they temporarily take us out of our pain and stress. They do not work in the long run because what they actually do is help us abandon ourselves. Easy buttons take us to fake heaven. Fake heaven always turns out to be hell. You know you've hit an easy button when afterward you feel more lost in the woods than you did before you hit it. It has taken me 40 years to decide that when I feel bad, I want to do something that makes me feel better instead of worse. I keep a handwritten poster in my office titled Easy Buttons and Reset Buttons. On the left are all the things I do to abandon myself. On the right are my reset buttons, the things I can do to make staying with myself a little more possible. Easy buttons. Boozing, binging, shopping, snarking, comparing, reading mean reviews, inhaling loads of sugar and passing out. Reset buttons. Drink a glass of water. Take a walk. Take a bath. Practice yoga. Meditate. Go to the beach and watch the waves. Play with my dog. Hug my wife and kids. Hide the phone. My reset buttons are just little things. Big thinking is the kryptonite of high and low folks like me. When everything is terrible and I hate my life and I feel certain that I need a new career, a new religion, a new house, a new life, I look at my list and remember that what I really need is probably a glass of water. 5, remember that we are the best people. I'm an artist and an activist, so pretty much all my friends struggle with what our culture has defined as mental illness. These people are the most alive, passionate, kind, fascinating, and intelligent humans on Earth. They live different kinds of lives than the type we're trained to aspire to. Many of them live lives that include spending days in the dark without leaving their homes and holding on to words and policy and paintbrushes for hope and dear life. This kind of life is not easy, but it's often deep, true, meaningful, and beautiful. I have begun to notice that I don't even enjoy folks who aren't at least a tad mentally ill. I don't wish folks without a little anxiety or depression any harm. I just don't find myself particularly curious about them. I've come to believe that we crazies are the best people. This is why so many of us are resistant to taking our medication. Because deep underneath, we believe that we are actually the sane ones. We mentally ill are the only sick people who believe our magic is inside our disease. I did. I still do. When people said, get better, I heard, get the same as everyone else. I knew I was supposed to hang my head and declare that my way of being was dangerous and wrong and everyone else's way was better and right. I was supposed to get fixed, join the troops, and fall into line. Sometimes I desperately wanted that, because living my way was so hard. Sometimes I could make myself accept that my inability to live lightly and pleasantly in the world I'd been born into was chemical, and that I needed help integrating like everybody else does. I needed to say, uncle, and admit, it's not you, world, it's me. I'll get help. I need to get better. I need your science. But other times, when I turn on the news or watch closely how people treat each other, I raise my eyebrows and think, actually, maybe it's not me. Maybe it's you, world. Maybe my inability to adapt to the world is not because I'm crazy, but because I'm paying attention. Maybe it's not insane to reject the world as it is. Maybe the real insanity is surrendering to the world as it is. Maybe pretending that things around here are just fine is no badge of honor I want to wear. Maybe it's exactly right to be a little crazy. Maybe the truth is, world, you need my poetry. I've got these conditions, anxiety, depression, addiction, and they almost killed me, but they are also my superpowers. The sensitivity that led me to addiction is the same sensitivity that makes me a really good artist. The anxiety that makes it difficult to exist in my own skin also makes it difficult to exist in a world where so many people are in so much pain, and that makes me a relentless activist. The fire that burned me up for the first half of my life is the exact same fire I'm using now to light up the world. Don't forget, we need their science because they need our poetry. We don't need to be more pleasant, normal, or convenient. We just need to be ourselves. We need to save ourselves because we need to save the world. Comfort zones. I used to stay brokenhearted like it was my job and destiny. Like pain was what I owed to the world, and staying sad was how I stayed safe. Self-denial was how I earned my worthiness, my goodness, my right to exist. Suffering was my comfort zone. I decided, at 40 years old, to try a new way. I chose Abby. I chose my own joy. I chose to believe, as Mary Oliver promised, that I don't have to be good. I can just let the soft animal of my body love what it loves. I made this choice out of love for myself and Abby, and also out of curiosity. I wondered if joy had as much to teach me as pain did. If so, I wanted to know. I'm not sure what the path of joy will teach me in the long run. Choosing joy is new for me. But I've learned this much: it's nice to be happy. I feel lighter and clearer and stronger and more alive. I haven't been struck down yet. One thing that has surprised me is this: the happier I become, the happier my children seem to become. I am unlearning everything I've been trained to believe about motherhood and martyrdom. In our wedding book, my son wrote, "Abby, before you came, Mom never turned our volume up past 11. Thank you. I hope that my new belief that love should make you feel both held and free is a belief my children will keep. I've also learned that while choosing joy makes it easier for me to love myself and my life, it seems to make it harder for the world to love me. I was speaking at an event recently, and a woman stood up in the audience, looked at me on stage, and said into the microphone, "Glennon, I used to love your writing so much. When you talked about your pain and how hard life was, I felt so comforted. But lately, with your new life, you seem different. I have to be honest, I'm finding you harder and harder to relate to." "Yes," I said, "I understand. I'm happier now. I'm not doubting myself as much, and that is making me confident and stronger, so I'm suffering less. I have noticed that it seems easier for the world to love a suffering woman than it is for the world to love a joyful, confident woman. It's hard for me, too. I was at one of Tish's soccer games, and there was a girl on the other team who was just rubbing me the wrong way. I could tell by the sideline body language and eye rolling that she was also rubbing several of my soccer mom friends the wrong way. I watched her carefully, trying to figure out why this girl was activating us. I noticed that she walked with her head held high and with a bit of a swagger. She was good, and she knew it. She went in for the ball often and hard, like a girl who knows her own strength and talent. She smiled the whole time, like all of this was easy for her, like she was having the time of her life. All of this just annoyed the hell out of me. She was 12. I sat with my feelings and I realized the knee-jerk reaction I'm having to this girl is a direct result of my training. I have been conditioned to mistrust and dislike strong, confident, happy girls and women. We all have. Studies prove that the more powerful, successful, and happy a man becomes, the more people trust and like him. But the more powerful and happy a woman becomes, the less people like and trust her. So we proclaim, women are entitled to take their rightful place. Then, when a woman does take her rightful place, our first reaction is, she's so entitled. We become people who say of confident women, "I don't know. I can't explain it. It's just something about her. I don't like her. I can't put my finger on why." I can put my finger on why. It's because our training is kicking in through our subconscious. Strong, happy, confident girls and women are breaking our culture's implicit rule that girls should be self-doubting, reserved, timid, and apologetic. Girls who are bold enough to break those rules irk us. Their brazen defiance and refusal to follow directions make us want to put them back into their cage. Girls and women sense this. We want to be liked. We want to be trusted. So we downplay our strengths to avoid threatening anyone and invoking disdain. We do not mention our accomplishments. We do not accept compliments. We temper, qualify, and discount our opinions. We walk without swagger and we yield incessantly. We step out of the way. We say, "I feel like," instead of "I know." We ask if our ideas make sense instead of assuming they do. We apologize for everything. Conversations among brilliant women often devolve into competitions for who wins the trophy for hottest mess. We want to be respected, but we want to be loved and accepted even more. I once sat with Oprah Winfrey at her kitchen table, and she asked me what I was most proud of in my life as an activist, writer, mother. I panicked and started mumbling something like, "Oh, I don't feel proud. I feel grateful. None of it's really me. I'm surrounded by great people. I'm just incredibly lucky." And she put her hand on mine and said, "Don't do that. Don't be modest." Dr. Maya Angelou used to say, "Modesty is a learned affectation." You don't want modesty. You want humility. Humility comes from inside out. I think of what she said to me every day. She was saying, playing dumb, weak, and silly is a disservice to yourself and to me and to the world. Every time you pretend to be less than you are, you steal permission from another woman to exist fully. Don't mistake modesty for humility. Modesty is a giggly lie, an act, a mask, a fake game. We have no time for it. The word humility derives from the Latin word humilitas, which means of the earth. To be humble is to be grounded in knowing who you are. It implies the responsibility to become what you were meant to become, to grow, to reach, to fully bloom as high and strong and grand as you were created to. It is not honorable for a tree to wilt and shrink and disappear. It's not honorable for a woman to either. I've never pretended to be stronger than I am, so I'm sure as hell not going to pretend I'm weaker than I am. I'm also going to quit requiring modesty from other women. I don't want to find comfort in the weakness and pain of other women. I want to find inspiration in the joy and success of other women, because that makes me happier, and because if we keep disliking and tearing down strong women instead of loving them, supporting them, and voting for them, we won't have any strong women left. When I see a joyful, confident woman moving through the world with swagger, I'm going to forgive myself for my first reaction because it's not my fault. It's just my conditioning. First reaction: who the hell does she think she is? Second reaction: she knows she's a goddamn cheetah. Halle-fucking-luja. Elmers. I've always judged harshly my parenting generation's obsession with their kids' sports. I've pitied the parents who spend their weekends and paychecks carting their kids all over the country to watch them kick balls or do handsprings. Each time a friend tells me about the scholarship her kid got to college, I say, "That's wonderful." And I think, "But didn't you spend at least that much on leotards and shin guards and hotels?" For a very long while, my athletic goal for my children was mediocrity. I wanted them to learn enough about sports to avoid embarrassing themselves in gym class, but not enough to become talented and ruin my weekends. When the girls were young, they wanted to try gymnastics, so we drove to the local gym once a week, and they rolled around and pointed their toes while I read and periodically looked up to yell, "Nice, honey!" This was a perfect scenario until the coach approached me after practice and said, "Your girls show real promise. It's time for them to start coming 3 times a week. I looked at her, smiled, thanked her, and thought, "Time for a new sport." The following week, we joined the soccer house league. The girls had fun, and since there was zero pressure or real learning, I felt confident that we could continue to meet our mediocrity goal. After the divorce, Tish began to fade. I watched her slowly retreat into food for comfort and spend more and more time alone in her room. I knew she needed to move her body more, but I also know from personal experience that suggesting this to a child will backfire. Tish was 10. I was 10 when I fell into bulimia. My baby looked like she was teetering, right on the edge of falling. I was afraid. I sat on the couch with Abby one night and said, "I think we need to get her back into therapy." Abby said, "I disagree. I think she needs to get out of her head, not deeper into it. I've been thinking about this a lot. I want Tish to try out for an elite travel soccer team." Me: "I'm sorry. What did you just say? Have you met Tish? That child would not run if the house were on fire. And those travel girls have been playing since birth. No, thank you. We are trying to help her, not humiliate her." Abby: "I've got a hunch here. She's a natural leader. She gets the spark in her eye when we talk about soccer. I think she might love it." Me: "No chance. She's way too fragile right now. What if she doesn't make it and it breaks her?" Abby: "What if she makes it and it makes her?" Behind my back, Abby called Craig, a lifelong soccer player, and it quickly became 2-1. The plan was to approach Tish and ask if she'd like to try out for an elite travel soccer team against my will and better mama judgment. One day after school, all three of us sat Tish down. She froze and looked warily at us. After a divorce, kids are in fight-or-flight mode for a long while. She asked, "What happened? More bad news?" Craig said, "No, no more bad news. We're wondering if you'd be interested in trying out for a travel soccer team." Tish giggled. We didn't giggle with her, so she stopped. She looked at Craig, then me. Then her eyes locked on Abby. Tish, "Wait, are you serious?" Abby, "Yes." Tish, "Do you think I could actually make it?" I opened my mouth to say, "Well, honey, the truth is that these girls have been playing much longer than you have, and don't forget that just trying out is so brave, and we will not focus on outcome, just our input." But before I could speak, Abby looked Tish dead in the eyes and said, "Yes, I believe you could make it. You have potential and passion. Somebody's got to make it. Why not you?" Oh my God, I thought. She is reckless. She has no fucking idea what she is doing. Without taking her eyes off Abby, Tish said, "Okay, I'll try." "Awesome," Craig said. "Cool," Abby said. "Danger ahead," I thought. We three smiled at Tish. Tryouts were 4 weeks away. Tish, Abby, and Craig spent those weeks at the elementary school practicing shooting and in our living room watching old women's national team games. Abby and Craig traded texts and emails about training strategy. Tish and Abby talked about the game so incessantly that soccer became the official second language of our home. They also went for runs together each day, which never went smoothly. Tish complained and cried the whole way through. One afternoon, they walked into the foyer together, sweating and panting. Tish continued her run right up the stairs, stomping the entire way. Before she slammed the door to her room, she screamed, "I can't do this! I hate it! I can't do this!" I froze and began to consider what medications we might prescribe Tish after this dangerous experiment failed and we had officially ruined her life. Again. Abby turned toward me and looked into my eyes. "It's fine," she said. She pointed upstairs. "That? That's exactly right. Don't go up there. She'll be down in a bit." Tish came downstairs in a bit, red-eyed and quiet. She sat on the couch between Abby and me. We watched TV for a while, and during a commercial break, Abby said, without taking her eyes off the TV, "I hated running every single day of my career. I cried about it all the time. I did it because I knew I couldn't be great if I wasn't fit, but I freaking hated every minute of it." Tish nodded and asked, "When are we running tomorrow?" The weeks pass, and now we are driving Tish to her first day of tryouts. I have both my hands wrapped around a gigantic travel mug filled with stress relief tea. When we arrive at the fields, all the other girls are in their shiny travel uniforms, and Tish is in a summer camp t-shirt and PE shorts. She is also at least a foot shorter than all of the other girls. When I point this out to Abby, she says, "What? No, she's not. Babe, when it comes to Tish, you've got some kind of projected body dysmorphia. Look closely, she's as tall as the rest of them." I squint and say, Well, she's littler inside. Abby says, "No, she's not, Glennon. No, she's not." Tish, Abby, Craig, and I huddle up. Tish looks at me and her eyes are watery. I hold my breath. Abby looks at me and widens her eyes. I want to say, "Baby, let's forget about all of this. Mommy's got you. Let's get back in that car and go get some ice cream." Instead, I say, "I believe in you, Tish. This is a hard thing to do. We can do hard things." She turns away from us and begins to move slowly toward the field. I watch her walk away from me and toward this very, very hard thing, and never in my life has my heart traveled so far up my throat. She looks so small, and the sky, field, and task ahead of her are so big. She keeps walking, though, away from us toward the sideline bench where the other girls are sitting. As soon as she makes it to the bench, she and we realize, oh my God, oh my God, there is no room left on the bench for her. She stands awkwardly off to the side. She doesn't know what to do with her hands. She is on the fringe. She is outside the golden circle. She does not belong. She is not one of them. Abby grabs my hand. You okay? Me. No. This is a mistake. Abby. This is not a mistake. I grab my hand back and pray. Please, God, if you exist, make them be nice to my daughter. Make them invite her into the circle. Make the ball go into the goal every time she touches it, or just create some other kind of soccer miracle so she'll somehow make this team. If all else fails, send an earthquake. But please, God, let this be over soon, because my heart cannot take this. Tryouts begin. Tish doesn't seem to know what she's doing. She loses the ball often. She isn't as quick as the other girls. She looks over at Abby several times, and Abby smiles and nods at her.